Support for WKAR is provided by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Current state for Monday, April 15th. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. One little nugget coming out of the Governor's Conference on Michigan Tourism, which is happening today at the Renaissance Center in Detroit. They're still skiing at Boyne Mountain. There's 2 to 5 feet of snow on the hill up there. And they might be skiing, get this, they might be skiing there into the first weekend of May. I believe that every year they devote a day at Boyne to skiing and golf. You make a run down the hill, then you go play a round of golf. It might be May this year, if you can't beat them. Later on the show today, we've got some terrific steel drum music from MSU's Latin is America Festival, which really gets into high gear here today. We're going to be talking with Mark Sullivan, who's involved, ironically, with computer music at MSU, but he's also going to talk to us about steel drum music. So talk about both ends of the musical spectrum. Mark is involved in that. Also, later on, we're going to talk with East Lansing's Douglas Jester, the former mayor of East Lansing, about development plans for downtown East Lansing. Those are taking shape as well. But for now, for months, some Lansing residents have been trying to persuade a neighborhood business to invest in a makeover. Recently, with the involvement of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, or LEAP, it appeared progress was being made between the Walnut neighborhood and Nyowave. However, it now appears some Walnut residents have doubts they'll get the makeover of the company's pole barn that they would like. Returning to current state by phone to update the situation is one of those involved residents, Mary Elaine Keener. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
Recently, you and your neighbors have been responding to a plan to fix the facade of a 14,000-foot square-foot pole barn that suddenly went up last summer that upset a lot of people. What kind of makeover plan is being considered here?
The plan that we were presented with would be to include brick. As you know, the current building is blue and white steel. There's blue on the bottom part of the building, and then white steel and silver steel roof. And what the current proposal offers is over the blue on the bottom on two sides of the building to have brick facing, and then to paint the white walls a color that, according to the drawing, would sort of match, correspond to the color of the school building, so a darker color than just white, and that there would be some faux windows, fake windows, affixed to the steel walls on those two sides that have the metal siding.
Now, did the makeover plan change at some point? Is this a different plan from what you originally looked at?
This is really the first plan that we have seen presented to us. We had been asked to tell us what you want. And we gave, we offered a couple of options where we were asking for, because we had been told by the builder who had built the building in a meeting that the upper part of the walls could have, it's called, the official name is IFIS. I don't remember what the letters stand for, but it's like a fake stucco, which is very commonly used, what you often see on new construction going up.
Yeah.
And that was our request, because it would take away the industrial look, and then to have windows installed to break up the expanse of the wall. And what came back, Leap, the folks at Leap have been helping with the negotiations with that. What came back was, no, we're not going to do the stucco. We will paint the, they would paint the siding, the upper siding. There would be brick covering the blue on two sides only, and the roof was going to remain the same. We had asked for architectural shingles, but then learned that because of the way the original building was constructed, that we couldn't, they couldn't do. They simply, that wasn't feasible. So that, and what they presented to us was they were not willing to do anything with the roof.
Well, clarify too, because
yeah.
Is what you're looking at what appeared in City Pulse a couple of weeks ago?
Ah, what appeared in City Pulse a couple of weeks ago was a rendering with a darker roof, although the darker roof hadn't been agreed on, hadn't been agreed to.
Okay.
So what Niowave has agreed to is the white roof, and what appeared in City Pulse then was, well, what Niowave has agreed to plus the a dark roof, which we had asked to, but they hadn't agreed to yet.
Well, on the website you've set up to keep people up to date on this, you state the following, and I'm abbreviating just a little bit. Quote,
sure.
Niowave's proposed facade presents us with a difficult choice. Is the proposed new facade better than what is here now? Unquote. That suggests the plan that has ended up on the table for consideration by the neighborhood is so inadequate that what's there now may be as good? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's the choice that my fellow neighbor, Dale, and I were faced with at a meeting at Leap last week. Here's this appears to be the best that we can do. It was a difficult forced choice. What do you folks want to do? Do you want to leave it the way it is, or do you want to accept something that that we knew was we frankly were very concerned that it might end up looking worse than what is there now. Right now, what we have is an industrial-looking building that's serviceable, it's just in the wrong place. And what we were asking for is to make the building that glares blue and white, help it blend into the neighborhood more. And some of the, if the white roof, which glares, were to remain, if having windows affixed to a metal siding instead of being installed, we were frankly concerned that this was going to draw still more attention to the building because it would look artificial and look fake.
Oh, boy. Well, talk to us about the timetable and what's happening now here, Mary Elaine. I know you've begun a process where residents are commenting.
Yes.
Where does that stand?
It stands, we've been, so as you said, I created an update, which I have a link. The link is at askmehouse.com/survey. Which folks can get an overview, and we decided, Dale and I felt we could not answer for the neighbors. We were being asked, and we needed, we wanted to get some more input from the neighbors, from the community. This has become a community-wide issue to best know how to respond. Looking ahead 5-10 years, what are people going to want to see there? And so we created a survey. It's up there. We're taking responses through tomorrow, Tuesday at 5 p.m., and that will help us compile a report in response. And so far, we've been getting some great input, which was why we had decided to extend the deadline. We really wanted to make sure more people had the opportunity to respond.
How many people from the Walnut neighborhood are involved in this, are weighing in on this? I mean, is it a smaller number than you'd like, or is some kind of consensus forming?
Well, I can't say there's a consensus forming, and we've gotten a really nice representation of responses, both from the immediate neighbors who are within like a 500-foot radius. And I have a question on the survey that lets us know where people are responding from. So in reporting the results, you know, we can look at the immediate neighbors, the rest of Walnut neighborhood, the city of Lansing, and even you know, if listeners in Okemos or trying to get some people to weigh in. I'm also hoping to get some feedback from folks who are involved in the construction field that can help give us some ideas of how to make this not be worse than what we're already stuck with.
So. Yeah. Well, the Lansing City Council is going to play a role in this eventually, because it still has to decide whether to approve a tax abatement for NioWave. How does that figure into this now?
Well, I anticipate at this point that they will receive a copy of the report, and that will help with their deliberations.
A copy of the report. Clarify what you mean by that.
I will, of the summary, after tomorrow afternoon, I will be preparing a summary of the responses, together support. Yeah. And, our goal all along and has been, we wanted to be able to come together with a consensus of neighbors saying, yes, we can fully support this, so that we could come forward to City Council and say, because that's what council's waiting for, has been waiting for the neighbors to come and say, yes, we agree, so that then we would help support the tax abatement. At this point, I don't see that support coming forward.
What's been any direct comment from City Council people on this?
No.
No.
Not yet.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Mary Elaine, we appreciate the update, and we wish you luck. And Mary Elaine Keener is with the Walnut Neighborhood Association, joining us on the phone from California, dark and early this morning. Thanks, Mary Elaine.
Thanks, Mark.
The extraordinary sound of steel drums there, all a part of the Latin Is America Festival here in East Lansing, coordinated through the MSU College of Music. Overall, the Latin Is America Festival is described as an artistic exploration of interwoven Latin American and U.S. cultures. It is off to the races today, and events take place all the way through the 27th of this month at various locations around the MSU campus, and it includes concerts, films, art exhibits, plays, and lots more. And we've got a couple of steel drum players in the studio here this morning. Jim Koviak is a member of the Steelheads steel drum band.
That's correct. I'm the director of the group.
You're the director of the group, and you reign from where? Where are you from?
Flint, Michigan, Mott Community College, and Mott Middle College High School.
Very good. And Mark Stone is a member of the Pan Jumbies. Hi, Mark.
Hey there.
You're from Oakland?
Oakland University.
Oakland University. Extraordinary.
Yep. Also the director of the group.
Okay, very good. Well, it's great of you to come in here. What is happening? You've got a performance of steel drum music today or tonight then?
That's correct. We've got an amazing cast of players. Andy Norell, of course, one of the most well-known steel drum players on the planet. And Relator, a Trinidadian vocalist. He's also going to be performing. Mark Walker, Etienne Charles. It's going to be a phenomenal concert. The MSU Big Band is performing. And all of this music is arranged for full big band and full steel band orchestras, which is unusual.
That was one of my top questions was what constitutes a steel drum band? It's a lot more than just the drums themselves.
Well, the steel band itself is an orchestra, and down in Trinidad they play up to 120 players. So truly a complete orchestra.
Wow.
I learned to play the steel drums in West Virginia. West Virginia University, where one of the pioneers of the instrument, Ellie Manette, was living. And as he developed the instrument and his colleagues developed the instrument, they had the idea of developing a full range of sounds just like a symphony orchestra. And so we used to play classical music on pan as well as jazz and calypso. And when you go down to Trinidad, you'll hear this massive sound. They have bass steel drums, huge 55-gallon oil barrels, played up to 12 of them at a time, and then all the way up to like the equivalent of the violin, which they call the tenor pan, which is just a single oil barrel cut very short with many small notes on it.
I'm sitting here trying to imagine what the first steel drum must have sounded like compared to the instruments that you guys play now. It's just a totally different universe.
Yeah, well,
it?
The earlier steel drums sounded more like a xylophone. They hadn't tuned the overtones yet. So the earliest steel pans were a little clunkier.
Okay.
Yeah, but still, actually, the early pans also have a beautiful sound. But what's different with the modern pan is they tune the overtone, so it has a very bright, resonant sound.
Jim, how were you first introduced to steel drum music?
Well, I actually went out and bought Andy Norell's first CD, which came out in the 80s when I was a percussion major at CMU. And then when I decided to go to grad school, I ended up at one of the schools that had one of the first college steel drum bands in the United States, and that was the University of Akron. And that's where I really got hooked on playing steel pan. And then my professor, Robert Honer, asked me to come back and start a band at CMU.
How about you, Mark?
Well, as I said, I went to grad school at West Virginia University, and Ellie Manette, who's one of the developers, creators of the instrument, was there. And I got there, and he had this big symphony of steel, 50-piece steel band, again, one of the early collegiate steel bands, and got totally hooked. They say pan has a jumbi in it. The word jumbi means something like spirit, and it's that, I think it happens to a lot of people. They hear that sound, and it just hooks them right away. And with my own students at Oakland University, I enjoy watching them have that same experience as they start to play the pan, and they just get hooked on the sound and the great music. And
I'm accustomed to hearing steel drum music, really maybe just one, with other players. It's hard for me to sit here and imagine how many at a time. How many steel drum players?
Well, I think tonight we're going to have about 30. But down in Trinidad, there'd be like up to four times that many. But with a 30-piece group that we'll have tonight, it's a really magnificent full sound, and that's not even including the big band. So it's going to be a really wonderful concert. Encourage listeners to come out to it. Encourage you to come out to it.
It really requires players to really play together as an ensemble more
Absolutely.
Than probably decades ago when maybe there might have been one. What other instruments typically play in a steel drum ensemble, Jim? You got drummers, you've got singers.
Right. There's also one of the parts of the steel band is called the engine room, and it has some of the original instruments from steel bands before there were any actual pitched instruments, and it's called the brake drum or the iron, and they're actual brake drums from cars, so they're just metallic percussive instruments.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of those along with some cowbells and shakers, and we've got a conga player and the drum set, and that's the group of musicians that just drives the whole rest of the band. And it's really an amazing, exciting sound, just the engine room itself.
Let's give a listen to it right now. That's you in there, Jim Koviak. We're hearing on the radio. Tell. I'm very curious how steel drum players end up in the band. You yourself were a percussionist, but do some come from non-percussion backgrounds?
Absolutely. I would say most come from non-percussion backgrounds, which is kind of another unique thing about the instrument.
Because I'm sitting here thinking, okay, anyone whose passion for music is harmony and melody is probably going to be less inclined to go the percussion route, because there's less of that in the percussion world than there is if you're a horn player or a singer or a piano player. You're saying most of the people that come to end up in a steel band actually come from that harmony melody background. Is that right?
I would probably say so. What do you think, Mark?
Oh, yeah. A lot of my students are vocalists or guitar players, but many are percussionists as well. And to be a percussionist, we study melody and harmony just as much as any other instrument.
I'm oversimplifying a little bit. I do realize that percussion, they play xylophone.
And a lot of my students who are percussionists, they're coming from a background playing the marimba or so on. So they catch on to playing the steel pan quickly.
Okay. And where are you performing tonight? Tell us that.
We're performing at the MSU Community School of Music, and the concert starts at 7:30. And we're expecting a full house, so be sure to get there early. The rehearsals have been going extremely well. I'm really, really excited about this concert, and you won't forget it. It's something that you won't forget it, so you won't want to miss it.
Is there a website they can go to learn more about this? I imagine if you Google Latin is America, you're off to the races. So we'll just leave it at that.
That's correct, and I think there might even be a link to watch on the internet live.
Okay.
Yeah. It's going to be live webcast. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Jim Koviak is with the Steelheads band, and Mark Stone is with the Pan Jumbies from Mott Community College and Oakland University, respectively, all part of the MSU Latin is America Festival. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Every Monday morning, MLive's Angela Whitrock joins Current State to talk about business, the economy, and development. And this morning, we are joined by a guest we're eager to talk to. Former East Lansing Mayor Douglas Jester is playing a leading role helping the city move ahead on new downtown development. Douglas heads a public panel that's been reviewing proposals to develop 2.8 acres or thereabouts of city-owned downtown property. Some plans call for hotels, student residences, farmers markets, office space, outdoor venues, and on and on. And over the coming days, the panel's expected to narrow the field and finally recommend one to the East Lansing City Council. Good morning, Angela. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Mark.
And good morning, Douglas Jester. Good to see you.
Good morning. My pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming in.
Mr. Jester, can you kind of remind us where we are in the process and what exactly it is that these proposals entail, what we're looking at?
Of course. The area in question is in downtown East Lansing. It's north of Grand River Avenue and west of Abbott Road. It's an area where there was a project proposed some years ago called City Center 2. That project has fallen apart for various reasons, and the city is now engaged in an effort to pursue a new development path. Under the effort of that project, there was some land owned by the city that was going to be used and some owned by the private developer. That private developer still owns the land that he controlled, but isn't able to proceed with the project. So the city's effort now is to proceed with development of the city-owned property and then allow the developer of that property to include or not adjacent properties, including those of the former developer.
How is that playing out exactly? I mean, how is your panel, and how many people are on the panel? It's like 17 or 18?
I think it's 17.
Okay. How is your panel factoring this wild card into this whole process, since that's, that is part of some of the plans that has been presented?
It is. It's important to understand that the process we're going through now is not to choose a plan, but to choose one or more developers who will then work with the community to develop a plan. They submitted notional plans as a part of their proposal, but when we recommend to City Council and Council chooses to work with one or two or three of those developers and continue the process, the first obligation of the developer is to engage the community and do market analyses to determine what would be the most appropriate and desired use of this land, what kind of development should occur. So rather than saying up front, this is the proposal and this is what's going to be built there, we're saying, convince us you're qualified, that you have the capacity, the financial ability, and the intent to work with the community to build what would work best for us.
That's a little bit at odds with what's made it into the media,
I think.
You're not recommending a specific proposal. This is really about vetting a developer.
That's right.
As much as that.
That's right.
Can you speak a little bit more to what exactly are the top three qualities, I guess, in a developer that you would choose? I know there was in the previous incarnation of this development as City Center 2, you know, there was a lot of controversy there. What are you guys specifically looking at to avoid some of that problem again?
Well, first we're looking for a good, strong track record of doing developments successfully and developments that worked in the communities that hosted them. Secondly, we're looking at their current organizational and financial capacity. And thirdly, we're looking at their commitment to sustainability, community involvement, and other sorts of processes that will make a good development or a great development in that site.
Is Scott Chappelle or Strathmore or the owner of CATA? There's a lot of names that get drawn into this whole thing. Are you in touch with them about this process? Are they involved in any way?
Well, they certainly are aware of the process that the city's undertaken. Several of the proponents of specific proposals to us indicated that they had attempted to reach agreements to use Chappelle's property. One of them, DTN Management, has represented that they have an agreement that would allow them to incorporate Chappelle's property into this development if the development goes forward. But we are intent on choosing a developer and a proposal that are not dependent on such an arrangement.
Is the committee worried at all that having these three sort of blighted Strathmore-owned properties, that could still impact whatever the quality of the eventual development is of the city-owned properties?
Certainly in the short term, we are, but we don't think that from that we should conclude that we ought to tie this all into one development. We'll go ahead, if appropriate, with development on city-owned property in that area and leave it to Mr. Chappelle or others to redevelop those other parcels. It makes no sense financially or otherwise for him to continue to hold on to them undeveloped or in their current state. So we're expecting certainly that redevelopment will occur, just not making it necessary that it be a part of a package with the city property.
Describe the public feedback that you've received to the proposals. Is the public generally more involved or less involved in this plan than you would have thought?
Our process is designed to make sure that there is significant public involvement. Every step that the committee has taken, the documents are on the city website, cityofeastlansing.com. There's a link right off of the front page there. All of the meetings have been public, and we've endeavored to be you know, very explanatory about what we're doing and transparent in each of the meetings. We've had pretty good participation, particularly from the people who reside in the immediate area. And then I've been invited to neighborhood meetings and things like that. So we're staying close to the community all through this.
A lot of the residents I've spoken with, especially who reside closer to downtown, are really worried that what they'll end up seeing is, will be characterized as like for the creative class type housing, but will really just be more expensive student housing. Is there any priority that the committee is placing on housing that's not specifically geared toward undergraduates?
Amongst the criteria we're evaluating on are not just the ability to finance a big project and execute it, but also to bring together all of the pieces of a mix of uses. So we want to make sure that the developer we choose has a history of being able to attract retail, office, non-student housing, as well as student housing. In the end, the project will have to be supported by the market. It would be perhaps surprising if it could be done without any student housing. But I think it's entirely feasible, based on what we know now, that there would be significant non-student housing combined with student housing and other uses.
Earlier, you mentioned the possibility of one or two or three mm-hmm. developers being recommended to the city council. Is it more likely that more than one will be recommended? Or do you expect one to be recommended?
This is just my judgment. The committee hasn't decided yet, but I think we probably will recommend to council that they enter into deeper due diligence and perhaps even some of the market analysis and planning processes with more than one developer.
Well, after that recommendation or recommendations are made, what happens to the other plans? Though can they go to the Court of Appeals and say, "Hey, this deserves another look. This is really a better plan than you realize."
No, the nature of the city's ownership of this property and the process we've set out is that it's like an application to become a developer to purchase the land from the city. So the city it's not a judicial process at all. There's no really valid path for appeal, as long as we do the right thing in terms of the interests of the city.
But are you essentially killing some prospect?
The city council would be free to ignore the advice of the committee, but okay. Effectively, I think yes.
Is there a consensus among the committee about some top priorities for what they would like to see there? A couple of the plans refer to a hotel and a permanent or somewhat permanent space for a farmer's market. Are there three or four things that you guys are really looking at that you want to make sure goes downtown?
In the committee's deliberations thus far, we focused on the qualifications of the developers, so I can't represent that the committee has a consensus view yet. From my conversations with other committee members, I think there is very real interest in enhancing our already successful farmer's market. A hotel would add to the vitality of the downtown. There's real interest in office, although questions about whether the market will sustain more office. And then we definitely want mixed use with retail on the ground level and then, residential and office above.
Douglas Jester heads a public panel that's reviewing proposals to develop a few acres of city-owned downtown property in East Lansing in the coming days. He will be, along with his panel, be recommending a developer or two or three to the city council. Douglas, thanks very much. Angela, see you soon.
See you soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sure.
Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu. You.